I didn't really want to speak, but I've been worrying about my talk all during the conference when I would much rather have been enjoying your talks. But anyway, I'm going to talk about some new ideas in regard to holographic singularity resolution, and this talk very much follows Gary's talk, and in fact his work, his earlier work. Part of this is in a paper with Ben Krebs and Thomas Hertog last year. I'm forever promising a paper this year, and then there's some very recent work with Misha Smolkin, who's a postdoc here, just joined us at PI. So let me just begin with a discussion about crime and disease. And, Lenny has... Perfect timing. So this is really following Jim Peebles' comments. I mean, it's quite clear that as theorists, as physicists, you have to commit crimes all the time. I mean, you have to decide to ignore certain questions and... It's not me. that was a question, yeah. You have to ignore certain problems. You've got to decide which things you think are really clues as to, you know, clues to new physics. And you've got to make some judgments about that. So we're all committing crimes all the time by deciding what to focus on. And those crimes usually lead to problems. And that's a great thing, as Jim Peebles emphasized. I mean, you pick a model, you push it until it breaks. And that might be because of observations, or it might be because it's theoretically inconsistent. And so in this talk, I'm going to focus on one particular crime, which I think we all commit, which is to ignore the most strikingly obvious fact about the universe, striking fact about the universe, which is that it apparently came out of a singularity. And so I view that as a huge crime, to ignore that fact. And, you know, what comes with this, what comes with that, ignoring that crime, are a bunch of diseases. And that's where Lenny's talk sort of comes in, because when we discuss inflation, I mean, people are just ignoring the question of initial conditions and then focusing on what comes out and discovering that not only is there an infinite landscape of possible universes coming out, but within that space-time, there are these problems of measures. And so... you didn't. But the disease was supposed to be a joke, and I hope you'll forgive me for it, but the final pictures looked an awful lot like chicken pox to me. Yes. Very good. Very good. This will come up later. Please do. Please do. So the focus of my talk is on tackling this particular crime, which is ignoring the singularity, and the hope is that in dealing with this crime, one might actually resolve a number of diseases of other scenarios for the universe. So the question is the singularity the key? That was actually in a paper by Roger Penrose a long time ago. I think was the title of the paper. Was it the gateway from a previous universe? Or was it the beginning of everything? And this is obviously a very important and a fun question to ask. And obviously, in dealing with this question, you want to tackle it in the simplest possible setup, simplest and cleanest possible setup, where you can really do calculations and trust the answers and hopefully get an unambiguous result. So I'll try to persuade you that we have made some progress towards that goal. Our most powerful tool, of course, is this wonderful idea of holography, where Lenny also comes in. And many of you are familiar with this, but the basic idea is that theory with gravity in a certain kind of box is actually dual to a theory with no gravity living on the boundary of that box, and that is a conformal field theory. So this is just an astonishing idea, and that quantum gravity could be described by a quantum field theory on, in fact, a particularly beautiful type of quantum field theory on a fixed background. And that's the topic of the talk. Now, Gary has already set the scene by explaining how in cosmology, when you try to discuss a cosmology within this framework, you find that the dual CFT has a Hamiltonian which is unbounded below. I put in brackets here on flat space because you'll see later in the talk that that's actually dependent on the background you study it on the geometry that this CFT studied on. But in any case, what this tells us is that we need to make sense of these CFTs. If we're going to discuss cosmology and tackle singularities, you have to deal with these field theories. If you just throw them out from the beginning because they have an unbounded Hamiltonian, you can't do any cosmology. Our guiding principle, my guiding principle in this talk, will be the conformal symmetry, which is fundamental to the whole setup. And of course, this is deeply related to the UV completeness of the field theory. So conformal symmetry means there's no preferred scale. And if you want a theory that doesn't depend on any cutoff or any scale, then it has to have that symmetry. So that will be the basic principle. I want a description of singularities which is UV complete and incorporates this conformal symmetry to ensure that. The setup I'm going to study, which we studied in this paper with Ben Krafts and Thomas Hertog, is, I think, the simplest setup in which you can examine this holographically. And that is to take M theory on ADS4 cross S7 modded out by ZK. So it's a four-dimensional cosmology, which is nice. It is the compactifying supergravity on ADS4 cross S7 is the simplest compactification there is, which is consistent with four dimensions. It's a very nice starting point. And then you mod out a particular fiber of the S7. You mod it out by ZK to shrink it down to small size, and this is useful for various technical reasons. So basically, this then looks like string theory. When you do that, you shrink the size of that circle, so it looks like string theory on ADS4 cross CP3. And then, as of course many of you are very familiar with, the beautiful thing about holography is that the isometry group of the bulk space, the space-time symmetry of the bulk space, is represented as the conformal group on the boundary field. These two groups agree. So here you have a three-dimensional theory, but it's invariant under this conformal group, which includes the usual symmetries of space-time, and then dilatations and special conformal transformations. And so that will be sort of fundamental to everything I discuss. So in order to progress with this, you see, if that's all I did, I have to specify some boundary conditions on this ADS4 because there's a boundary out there at infinity. And there are supersymmetric boundary conditions. In particular, and if I choose those boundary conditions, this setup is just stable. Nothing interesting will happen, and so it's not cosmology, and so I'm not interested in that. However, there's a simple tweak you can make to the picture which causes there to be a cosmology in the setup. And the tweak is done as follows. You take this theory of supergravity, and you, just for the purpose of defining boundary conditions, you truncate it to a subset of modes. And so these are all the Kaluza-Klein zero modes, and let's furthermore just keep one of them. So we're going to keep gravity, we'll keep the scalar, a scalar field. I'm just going to make a particular choice here, which is a quadrupole mode of the seven sphere. So that's represented as a scalar field on the bulk. And transforms as a traceless bilinear under SO8, the SO8 transformations of the seven sphere. When you truncate to this single scalar field, you get a scalar potential for it, which takes this form. It's negative, and the maximum of it corresponds to the ADS4 solution, where phi equals zero, and the four-dimensional space is ADS, and the internal space is just a seven sphere. Yes. I mean, it's everything's fine. Yeah. Okay, so that's the sort of, from this point of view, the trivial vacuum is where phi is zero. And as a cosmologist, you know, one finds it very surprising that people study this setup where the field is at the maximum, because it obviously looks unstable. But the point is that De Sitter space has a characteristic ADS space, has a characteristic radius or size, and when you impose these boundary conditions, it's a bit like holding the system in a box, and provided the size of your box is smaller than the inverse mass of the field, that's good enough, because that's good enough to hold the box up the hill. So that's roughly speaking how it works with the standard boundary conditions. And so, more technically, this negative mass squared is minus 2. It has a tachyonic mass, but there's the Breitlohner-Friedman bound that as long as the mass is greater than this bound, you can actually stabilize this system with the right boundary conditions. So what we're going to do is just adopt non-supersymmetric boundary conditions, and now then it will be unstable, and it will run to a singularity. So to define these boundary conditions, again, I just look at this truncated set of fields. They're the only one, this is the only field which will have non-standard boundary conditions, so it's fine just to truncate to it. I am interested in the whole theory. I want all the other fields to be there, but this is the only one with unusual boundary conditions. So let us look at this field and study the general solution for this field just from the Einstein equations. Asymptotically at large radius in this ADS space. And so the general solution takes this form of a series inverse powers of R and with arbitrary coefficients which depend on the boundary. So the boundary has some time and it has an angular coordinate around this cylinder. So the boundary is just S2 cross R and the R there is time. Then the way in which the ADS, if you now operate with ADS isometries on this field, so do some symmetry transformation on the ADS, just a space-time coordinate transformation, that acts as a conformal group on these quantities, alpha and beta, which are operators in the CFT. And from this, you can identify the dimensions of these operators. And in particular, alpha, this quantity alpha is dual to some operator O in the CFT, and beta is corresponds, has the same transformation properties as the source for that operator. And when you work out the dimensions, the operator goes like phi squared in three dimensions. So this alpha is supposed to be represented by some quantity phi squared, a scalar field squared in the CFT, something with the dimensions of the scalar field squared in the CFT. Then the generalized ADS invariant boundary conditions which we'll use, and these were discussed by Hertog and Horowitz and other people, is that you can, instead of just setting one of these to zero, one or other to of these to be zero, which would be morally the same as Dirichlet or Neumann, you can use mixed boundary conditions. So again, by dimensions, you could guess that if there's a relationship between beta and alpha, because of the square here, beta has to be proportional to alpha squared. And what that means is that this source is proportional to the operator squared, which is phi squared. So if I construct the action, it should include the source times the operator, and therefore I'll have phi squared times phi to the fourth, in other words, phi to the sixth. So what this means is that if you adopt these deformed boundary conditions, you're actually adding to the CFT a source, is be a field within the CFT, and basically that means you're adding a deformation to the potential in the CFT of this form. So it's a completely self-contained system. Its dynamics is well determined, but it's not just the original CFT. So this was all discussed by Hertog and Horowitz. Now, actually, from their discussion, it wasn't totally clear what the sign of this this term was, because it looks here like the sign is, you know, if I pick the sign right, it looks like this would always be positive. But in fact, from the symmetry of the original theory, under phi goes to minus phi, the potential was crushed by, it's clear that one sign's got to be the same as the other sign. Okay, because I could just change phi to minus phi, and alpha would flip sign, and beta is alpha squared, so it wouldn't. Okay, so you can clearly change the sign of h just by some symmetry operation in theory, and so this can't quite be right. And in fact, it isn't quite right. There is a symmetry which you can use, and the upshot is that this potential always is unbounded below. Whatever the sign of h. Now, so this will be the picture. Let's pick the, well, as I said, it won't really matter what the sign is. So we pick some non-zero h, and we want to study the evolution of the bulk, for example, in the dual field.
I'll tell you about it. Okay. So.
First of all, let me just sort of further motivate this by showing you what happens if you pick these generalized boundary conditions. Then, as Thomas and Gary showed, what basically you have this minus cosh phi potential, and now it's possible for the scalar field, if you, for example, displace it in the bulk a little bit away from the maximum and just let it go, it's going to fall down the hill. And as it falls down the hill, imagine you displace it in the center of the space-time, and it falls down the hill. As it falls down the hill, these slices are constant scalar field slices, it will do so in a way which looks like a bubble. So the influence will spread out to the boundary, and within the bubble, you will produce a space-like singularity where the scalar field hits infinity. And so this is the way in which you generate the cosmology inside your box. And you can construct cosmological solutions to this by considering an O4 invariant instanton. It's just a function of one radial variable. And when you continue this instanton, it produces this expanding bubble, which runs out and hits the boundary at some finite time on the boundary. So in the dual theory, you have this negative phi to the sixth potential causing the scalar field to run to infinity in finite time, and these two times agree. That's one of the things in Gary and Thomas's paper, is they notice that if you calculate the time from the bulk point of view or the boundary point of view, you get the singularity at the same time. So a couple of years ago, ABJM identified the dual CFT, and it's a UM times UM Chern-Simons theory. There are actually two of these terms with opposite k's, which I didn't write them out. and it has a bunch of Higgs fields, but it is a 5 to the 6th scalar field theory with some other things. Of course, once you have this theory, now you have a very precise way of describing what's happening. There are two discrete parameters in this theory. It's a really beautiful theory. No free parameters, just two numbers, two integers, one of which is the M, which fixes the rank of the gauge group, and the other one is K, which has to be an integer for quantum consistency, and it's the inverse gauge coupling of the Jones-Simons field. So the way holography works, that we're interested in the limit where both M and K are large, where we fix the ratio M over K called the Tuft coupling, and then the holographic dictionary tells you that the radius of ADS to the Planck length is proportional to M and K. So if you take K and M large, you will be studying a space that's very far from the Planck length, much bigger than the Planck length. But the radius compared to the string length is the ratio of M over K. And so I'll discuss various limits of this, that you want to take K and M large, but maybe the ratio of them can be large or small. If I want to ignore the gauge fields, I take K to be very large, so G took is small, and a lot of my talk I will take that limit. But that's a less interesting limit, because then the string length is bigger than the radius of the ADS. There is a way of studying it at strong coupling, which I'll get to at the end of my talk. So we identified this operator, and basically the point is it's some quadratic trace. And the point is it has some pluses and some minuses. And so some of the fields, when you cube this operator, you're going to get a potential which in some directions is negative and other directions is positive. And it doesn't matter what the sign of the coefficient is. So in this particular example, there's actually a discrete set of choices you can make as to which quadrupole mode of the 7-sphere you keep. And this particular one I've chosen because it has a very nice bulk geometry, as I'll mention later. This one corresponds to a bulk, which when you hit the singularity from the 11D point of view, it's actually nil. And Milne is very special for a number of reasons. So we study this model, and let's begin by studying it at infinite K. So just forget the gauge fields, and then the model becomes very simple, because these are complex M by M matrices, but they have two M squared components, and so the kinetic terms obviously can be written as a sum of vector components where n is 2m squared. And this one has more. I didn't write that out explicitly, but this phi 2 includes all of these three fields, so it's another factor of 3. And so basically I have these two vectors, and then I have a potential term, which is the difference between the squares. Cubed. So we have these two fields, and one of them is classically unstable. That's the phi 1. So its potential would be minus phi 1 to the 6th. And the other one is classically stable. So you might be tempted to just ignore this guy, but that would be seriously wrong. As I'll show you, all of the interesting physics is actually going to be in this guy, in the stable one. So, you know, again, this is really amazing that using holography, you've taken this impossibly difficult problem of studying a singularity and turned it into something which looks almost trivial. So we're just going to do the quantum field theory of this set of fields on S2 cross R.
Infinite, right?
Yeah, exactly. So this would be correct if k equals infinity. Right. So in other words, there are corrections to this suppressed by 1 over k.
But this is the opposite limit from the Tuft limit. You keep m finite and you take k to infinity, right?
I take both m and k large. And then I'm working here in the ratio.
So m.
I'm working here in the ratio where m over k is small.
I see. M, what is m here?
N. N is 2n squared.
So this also so
n, yeah. Okay. Yeah. N is large. So basically I'm setting an O-N
times O-3-N, and these numbers vary depending on which precise case, which boundary conditions you use, but it's roughly speaking an O-N times O-N model, where one of the O-N fields has positive coupling and one negative coupling, and they have to be 5/6 because it's in three dimensions, and I've also forgotten to write down the R phi squared term. They should have an R phi squared term with conformal coupling. But if we study this in flat space, yeah, sorry, I shouldn't have written this. We study this in flat space, which I'll start off with, the R is zero. Yeah.
A field that would describe D2 grains moving in the radial direction. Are those contained in the Ys, or is that something different?
No, they are contained in the Ys.
So, okay, so when these instabilities involve the D2 grains flying out?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's this classically unstable field. Is the phi 1 is exactly the magnitude of phi 1 is related to the radius of the D2 brain, of the M2 brain.
It's D2 brain in type 2A language.
Okay. D2 and 2A. Actually, there's a paper by Alicia and Ben studying it from that point of view in some detail.
It's not supergravity
mode,
it's the brain moving.
Okay,
big question. Does quantum field theory with an unbounded negative potential make sense? We'll see. There is no ground state or equilibrium, certainly no thermal equilibrium. There's no canonical ensemble. But that sounds a good thing. We're trying to describe cosmology. Cosmology, we're not in thermal equilibrium. And so from my point of view, I don't see why one should rule it out for that reason. It's naturally got a mechanism to keep you away from equilibrium. That's good. Maybe just what we need. So in our paper we studied the renormalization of this theory. So actually, maybe let me just justify that with a few words. I've got this unstable scalar field phi 1, so clearly I'm going to run down the hill to large phi 1. When I do that, the energy scale I'm probing the theory at is going to rise, and so I need to know how this coupling runs with energy. So we studied that in our paper, and essentially, naively, you have these four couplings. There are four different types of terms allowed by the symmetry, and they can run differently. And so, in fact, this is the graph from our paper, and one of them, the positive one, goes to a constant. That's the UV fixed point, and the other ones all go to zero. What do you mean? No, this is just quantum field theory. Perturbation theory in one of red. So I'm just taking this model. The Tuff coupling is zero, just ignoring the gauge fields. So this is a very stringy regime. I'm going to cut off my study. Okay, so the nice thing is there's a UV fixed point when this coupling hits 192. And the other couplings all become small. Now, why does that happen? Well, this was understood in the 80s, that there are some very special properties in three dimensions. And that's interesting, because we live in four, and 3D is dual to four. And in three dimensions, the ON model has a UV fixed point at lambda equals 192. So you can study this systematically. Even though lambda is large, you can do an expansion 1 over n. And at leading order, at n equals infinity, the beta function is 0. This is exactly scale invariant theory at n equals infinity. But I can also work to next to leading order. And then there are only two diagrams which contribute. And here they are. One is lambda squared, and one is lambda cubed. And they're both log divergent. And you can, from them, you can work out this beta function. So the first point is suppressed by 1 over n. The running is small. This is not true in 5D cosmology. 5D cosmology is dual to a n equals 4 Young-Mills theory, when you deform it, the coupling runs, actually asymptotically free, but there's no, it runs all the way, sorry, it's asymptotically free, but it runs even at leading order in 1 over n. And the special thing in 3D is that the running is suppressed by 1 over n. So there's this UV, and the second thing is that there's this fixed value of lambda in UV. So that's good because we're going to expect the theory becomes conformal there, and so 4D cosmological singularities are going to be described by a truly conformal theory. I set k equals infinity.
Sorry. Zero to couple.
Well, in four dimensions, there's an analog of this, which is the Banks axis. If you allow yourself large numbers of flavors and small numbers of colors, there is an analog in four dimensions.
In the other regime of strong Tuff coupling,
so if I now take the other limit, large G Tuff, then you can actually use ADS-EFT to compute the potential. And Witten did this in the 5D cosmology. The calculation was done by Witten, and you can generalize that to this case, and it also indicates there's a UV fixed point. Yeah.
When you have the upper keys, so what you see is that your coupling runs into the strong coupling regime, right?
Sorry?
This is strong coupling regime, you're right.
No, it's not really strong. Lambda is large, but N is large. So, lambda is going to 192, but this perturbation expansion of 1 over N is perfect. There's nothing wrong. All the corrections are small. So this is under very, very good control, calculation control. The other point to make is that, I mean, this kind of UV fixed point is extremely robust.
In the sense that, you see, this is saying beta is positive at small lambda, and it's negative at large lambda. So if I come along and add some 1 over n squared correction, it will shift exactly where the 0 is, but it can't get rid of the 0. Likewise, if I add a 1 over k correction, you can add any other correction here where k is bigger than n, and it's not going to change the fact that there is a 0. So the fact there is a fixed point in the perturbative regime is absolutely robust in higher correction.
A lambda equal to 0, right? Because then the coupling is marginally relevant. Is that?
Sorry, in which case?
In the ADS-CFT calculation of the same thing, the fixed point is at lambda equal to 0.
No.
Because I thought we can show that in that case you get your coupling is marginally relevant in trans-like UCD.
No, not in 3. In 3D. I mean, basically what shows you that lambda doesn't run is
this power series expansion in 1 over r. The fact you have no logs means that lambda doesn't run.
Okay.
So, including this 1 over n running, it turns out that this kind of rather messy expression for the potential, in fact, factorizes. It wasn't obvious to us in our paper, but if you look carefully at this, there are actually the beta function equations for those lambdas are just such as to preserve the fact this is a cube. Okay, the lambdas all run. I don't quite understand why this works. It looks like a miracle. But you just do the counting properly and you work out the fact that this is a cube requires two relationships between those four couplings. And those relationships, if you fix them at one energy scale, they're actually preserved. And so it turns out that even with running, this renormalized potential is always a cube, okay, even at order 1 over n. Somehow, I mean, I don't know enough about ADS-CFT to know how profound a test this is, but it's sort of surprising that at non-trivial order in 1 over n, the whole picture that the potential was a source times an operator and therefore had to be a cube of the operator is valid. Okay, so that's interesting. It does work out this way. This gamma here is nothing but so basically I'm using lambda 2 to 2 as my coupling, and then the gamma is just the ratio of these guys to each other in lambda 2, 2, 2. And those ratios are preserved by the running. You can check that from the beta function equations. And this gamma goes to zero in the UV. So let's now discuss the dynamics of this running potential. Well, phi 1 is classically unstable. And as I mentioned already, the dynamics will be for phi 1 to run down the hill. And it's going to run down the hill according to this equation, where this is its self-coupling that will dominate. So if you start at small lambdas, much less than 192, basically the phi 2 will have a positive mass, and the phi 1 will have a negative value, and you'll just run down that value. And this is the solution, that phi 1 goes like some inverse power of lambda 1, 1, 1 times t to the half as t goes to 0. But, and here's the really interesting thing, as lambda 2, 2, 2 grows, the second field that you thought was stable actually goes quantum unstable. And the way that happens is that it turns out when lambda 2, 2, 2 gets bigger than 16 pi squared, then the Hamiltonian for phi 2 is unbounded below. And that's an entirely quantum field theoretic effect, which is nevertheless very easy to understand. And so this is the way it works. So you see, at infinite n, this theory is Gaussian. I can basically factorize phi to the sixth into products of Gaussians. And now I can say, let me take as a trial function for my field theory a Schrodinger picture, for example, a ground state for a free field of mass m. And I just compute expectation value of phi squared. And my potential is just going to be this quantity q. So you compute it, and you get infinity because there's cutoff dependence. But it's obvious that if you had some mass m, that decreases the answer. Okay, so this dependence on m must be negative. So you'll get some lambda, but then you have to get a minus m. And all that's happening here is that as you turn up the m, you're suppressing the low k modes in this expectation value. And therefore decreasing phi squared. So if I renormalize the theory, I can actually replace this phi squared. I can throw away the lambda. Another way of saying this is if I renormalize, I'm going to add counter terms in just such a way as to remove all the lambda dependence. And when I do that, I'll be left with this term. And now when I compute the potential, I'm going to get this cubed. And the cube of minus 1 is minus. And so you're going to get minus m cubed. So it turns out the expectation value of the kinetic terms give you a plus m cubed, just by dimensions. But the potential term, which is plus lambda phi to the sixth, when you compute its expectation value, you get minus lambda m cubed. With a
second one, when the first one was rolling, is that included here?
Yeah, it's really minuscule. I mean, you're okay. I'm going to speed up. Questions at the end. Particle production is yeah. So, okay, so this Hamiltonian, if lambda is bigger than 16 pi squared, the theory has
no ground state. Because I can always lower the Hamiltonian, lower the energy by making it bigger. So this was realized by these people, and unfortunately, 192 is bigger than 16 pi squared, and so even though you have this beautiful fixed point, the theory didn't make any sense. Except they were thinking about the wrong questions. And so in the 80s, people just gave up on this theory. But in fact, the resolution of this is this theory really does have a quantum scaling solution, which is stable, meaning that it spontaneously breaks time translation invariance, and it will run towards a singularity, and does so in an amazing way, which, unlike the classical negative potential, this state has no tachyons, no tachyonic modes, no instabilities, and it's really qualitatively different, and that's what governs the singularity. Okay, so I think in view of time, I'm not going to go through this, but basically you can solve a gap equation for this theory, and you can show that expectation value of phi squared goes like 1 over the time, it diverges. This is all consistent at leading order in 1 over n. And this instability dynamically breaks the conformal symmetry from SO32 to SO31. Just breaks all the generators involving d by dt. As phi 1 rolls, as phi 1 rolls down the hill, it's going to push us into this regime. And this slide was just to remind me to draw on the board that if I say phi 1 squared is C1 over mod C, that's the classical rolling of the phi 1 field, and phi 2 squared is minus C2 over mod T, it's negative, then you can just plot C2 and C1. And you can show that when you couple both of these fields together, the way in which it evolves is basically it goes on a straight line. So this is as you're running down the hill, you're running into the UV, C1 decreases, C2 increases, and essentially C1 goes to zero. So C1 goes to zero at a point just beyond this 16 pi squared. What happens then? So what happens then is that this phi 1 field ceases to scale. Okay, it actually goes over to an evolution with an exponent less than 1, and this completely dominates. So one way of saying it is that this strongly coupled field, if you like, has a much more powerful instability. And so it governs what happens at the singularity, and this guy barely keeps up. It's still diverging, but much more weakly. It's not scaling anymore. And the precise value you get here depends on your initial condition on the coupler. Okay, so this dominates as UV fixed point. We're in three dimensions. There's no trace anomaly in three dimensions, so we can change conformal frame when we describe this theory. So instead of describing the system in Poincaré coordinates for the bulk and Minkowski for the boundary, we can change frame. So here's my scaling solution for phi 2, and I just do a Weyl transformation. So phi 2 goes to t to the half phi. That makes this a constant, a negative constant, and the metric becomes the sigma. Okay, so this whole system is equivalent to this ON model on de Sitter space. But of course, what's happened is the singularity I had in Minkowski space is now just the future boundary of de Sitter, just like in Gary's picture with his cone. So you can now that you've got to de Sitter, you can just change coordinates to global coordinates, and the whole thing works. Still, very obviously, this is de Sitter in global coordinates. And so the solution of the field on the cylinder, of course, is just phi squared is 1 over cos tau. That's just the Weyl transformation. And on de Sitter, it's a constant. So then there's a sort of a mini holography working here, which is that the SO31, which I mentioned is unbroken, is just the isometry group of the de Sitter. Okay, and so now what you've done by going to de Sitter is make all the symmetry manifest as a space-time symmetry. Okay, and it's the de Sitter group, and its future boundary is the S2. So basically, we will follow the fields to this future boundary. So this is a very nice picture because there's no gravity, of course, here. This is the boundary of space-time, and there are no divergences possible. This was a renormalizable field theory. The 1 over n expansion is completely under control. And so there's no possibility of a disease. Now, having said that, there's always the... there's an important issue to do with bubble nucleation in the bulk. And I just want to... I probably don't have time to talk about this until after the talk, but just mention that's A is suppressed by e to the minus n. You can show these bubbles suppressed by e to the minus n in this picture. And B, much more interesting, when you go into this quantum scaling phase, no bubbles can form. That suppresses all the bubbles. You can show that those putative instantons that would have made bubbles actually have no negative bubbles once you go into this strongly quantum regime. So this, so now I have this theory on the sitter space. It's actually a Euclidean description of this theory, perfectly good Euclidean description. And in fact, the best way to study this theory on the boundary is to use a three-sphere. So I take that ON model on a three-sphere with conformal coupling, calculate whatever I like, e.g. the two-point function, and analytically continue it. And of course, you get exactly the same answer as you should, and it's the correct answer. Furthermore, in the Euclidean version of this, when lambda is in this, is approaching the UV fixed point, there are no diseases at all. This is just a perfectly good theory on a sphere. So the upshot of this is that these theories, which look sick on Minkowski space, this is a causal description, are actually very happy on the sitter space. Okay. And I think that's a really surprising thing. Something that you thought was hopelessly diseased is actually perfectly fine. The bulk picture is actually very simple. You're picking your boundary slices just to avoid the singularity. So you can pick your boundary to be a de Sitter, and then it just asymptotes to the bubble, and everything is totally fine. So it's a real cheap trick to avoid the singularity. Okay? But maybe it's a good trick. The dual theory
just like things for the ADS, that has its own coordinate horizon. I mean, that's
yes.
It's a coincide with this, or this falls within one patch.
Yep.
Okay, so you generate a mass, so there's no possibility of infrared singularities. This theory generates its own mass in the sitter. There are no infinities at the singularity. Euclidean continuation exists, and this is, as I was mentioning, is actually no tachyonic modes. And if you think about this, the reason for the instability was not because I had a potential that is negatively curved. It's nothing to do with that. It's the fact that you're squashing the low K modes by giving them a mass. And so the whole physics of the singularity does not involve anything tachyonic. And this is a very recent calculation that we've studied these instantons, which in the bulk you would worry there might be other bubbles which would nucleate and collide with your big bubble. And this is obviously something Lenny has raised with his obsession with bubbles. In the dual theory, there are things called Fubini instantons, which basically it's a scale invariant theory, so you can have instantons which are arbitrarily small, and they correspond to these bubbles in the bulk. But what you find is that these Fubini instantons in this quantum rolling phase are actually have no negative mode. So they don't cause bubbles. Now, the final thing, if I could have 1 minute, I want to explain how to get across the singularity. So we've got all the way to the singularity. Everything is totally finite. What do I do next? Okay, so some people would say that's the end. Don't think about this anymore. Singularity is somehow so far in the future we shouldn't worry about it, but I want to worry about it. And of course, that de Sitter is conformal to the Einstein cylinder. And so a very natural thing to do is to work on the Einstein cylinder. I've definitely got a boundary here on the Einstein cylinder, but a very natural thing is just to glue another copy of de Sitter on top of this one and identify the two on a common two-sphere. So the idea is I'm going to follow some field coming out of region one and somehow map it onto some field coming into region two. And so this is an S matrix. I mean, any state down here will give rise to some out state on this surface. And it's very good asymptotic outstate because de Sitter is absolutely wonderful at separating your particles and all that. And there's no gravity to worry about. And then I'll take that outstate and feed it into my next copy of de Sitter. But you might think that was ambiguous. How do I take a state on this two-sphere and map it to a state on the next two-sphere? Okay. Well, the trick is to demand SO31 invariants. The SO31 is the isometry group of this bulk. It's also the conformal group of that two-sphere. So basically, this is the mini holography. That all the correlators I determine will be covariant under this SO31, and I better insist on symmetry under SO31. So roughly speaking, you can say, do a de Sitter boost down here, and then map. That should be the same as mapping and then doing the de Sitter boost up here. It should commute. And it turns out if you impose that these commute, then the mapping has to be the identity. There's no other choice. We rest very heavily on this SO31. It's actually not hard to show this SO31 in the quantum field theory has to be anomaly free. There's no possibility of an anomaly in the symmetry which we rely on. So I'll just set this in words. If n equals infinity, you get a perfectly cyclic universe in this way, which will go on forever. But because of the running in 1 over n, proportional to 1 over n, you will get particle production again and again and again, but you can control this. Here's the little theorem. I won't show it to you. Particle creation across this bounce, I mean, it's a global phenomenon, but across this bounce, only occurs due to the running of the couplings. The Bogoliubov coefficient for producing particles actually happens to be the beta function, proportional to the beta function. So beta is beta, and this is parametrically small. So 4D cosmology bounces, whereas 5D cosmology does not. That's maybe a good thing. So I think I'll answer questions about strong coupling if there are. Maybe it's an alternative to inflation. And thank you.
Questions? Yes?
Okay, so I'm a bit bothered that your theory still has this potential, which you say some modes at least are minus 5 of the 6th potential, so they roll down in finite time.
Yeah.
So, well,
you have to
sort of say something about boundary conditions or some self-adjoint expansion or something.
Yeah. Well, what happens is this conformal picture seems to resolve that. So
without taking any boundary conditions, without having any equation, or are you putting
least in the 1 over n expansion in D without taking any particular boundary condition? I mean, basically because this field becomes, because it has an asymptotic state on this surface in the visible picture. Just
a unique state?
What?
A unique state?
No, it can go to a state, and then I take that, but the state then defines correlators on that S2. And I use those correlators to define the next, the outgoing state. So basically, even though you see it's singular in the Minkowski picture, but when I come to the de Sitter picture, I multiply it by phi squared, I multiply it by mod t. So it actually goes to zero in the de Sitter picture. And the weight, furthermore, the weight of this field is actually, it's a unitary. This weight means it's in a unitary representation of the SO31 of the conformal group on the two-sphere. So you don't seem to see any problem.
I mean, the usual problem came when you looked at inhomogeneities. I mean, you can't do it in zero mode because then everything is easy. But if you look at inhomogeneities,
but this is the general inhomogeneity looks like this. Okay. So basically, when you solve the equation for phi 1. You'll find some equation that has two solutions in T with arbitrary functions of X. And those two solutions both fall into unitary representation of a conformal group on the two-sphere. So just because you somehow insisted on there being an outstate I mean, the basic idea here is that, you know, there really is an S matrix at the singularity, and if I want the total S matrix going through the bounds, I just multiply them. Just take, you know, S1, S2, that's also unitary. So, it's a very, very simple idea.
But why shift coupling? There's a big effect from kinetic terms, which we know because the whole thing is basically G2 rings flying out in the presence of this strong deformational theory. So, I mean, it's not. I'm not even sure if it takes. A, you know, this.
Are you saying I'm using the wrong action? I mean,
Did a calculation of weak coupling, which was not meant to really describe a large radius coupling.
Okay. Let me describe
it. And I'm just saying, at strong coupling, it wouldn't be just a matter of working with a two derivative action and the corresponding equation motion that you use. Instead, there'd be all of the GDI terms that make a difference in evolution. So
at strong coupling, I should be able to use supergravity.
Yeah, so
I just solved these equations with the same boundary conditions, with these boundary conditions on the De Sitter slices.
You describe these D2 brains flying out.
I just use it.
Wait.
I can work in the strong tooth coupling limit.
Yeah.
I take supergravity and alpha prime corrections.
No, you have these Ys, right? Which have an unstable potential.
No, in the strong coupling limit, the bulk description is back.
Yes, and the bulk description includes D2 brains, which can come out into the bulk, and you have to ask what their potential energy is.
No, the bulk description is just supergravity with this minus Koch potential. I don't have any brains
there. You have to ask. There are brains. You have to put them in and say, what is the potential energy for those brains, given the deformation of the theory that you've made. And, you know, it can happen, and I thought you were saying that it does happen here, that, you know, the brains have an unstable potential, and they fly out. And all I'm saying is dynamics is determined by the potential combined with a very strong set of kinetic corrections that will, you know, affect this discussion of potential.
Maybe you should talk about this. I haven't worked on this.
But I think there's two broad pictures that you could look at. One is where you have explicit D-brain sources, and that you can do it. Neil is referring to a different picture where you deform the seventh sphere very much.
Well, I'm just saying the operator that you added to the field theory depends on these Ys, and it's not enough to just study the supergravity modes in the bulk. You have to also look at instabilities that involve moving brains. This is something we see in all sorts of ADS-CFT systems, right? It's come up in these condensed matter applications a lot recently. So since those operators that you wrote down depend on this y, and we know that the y, when you apply for the middle sphere reference, the eigenvalues describe the motion of D2 brains. It sounds like a case where you...
So you're saying these operators, like in the radius CFT, we have some hypermultiprint sometimes, and they're like dual to some brain observations. So.
Or even just adjoint scalars and, you know, the simplest examples.
Okay.
So it can happen that the supergravity all looks fine, those are all stable, but after you stick a brain there and look at its potential, it flies out. It sounds like that's kind of...
Well, we want them to fly out.
Well, okay.
That's exactly what they should do.
Okay.
Well, it's already 6:20, so I suggest we stop now. Thank you.